Yo, what is a cypher?
Fuck the rules. Like, you don't gotta do a whole verse.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from? The gods.
Cause you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This week, we have episode 119, a talk with Danon Porter. Porter is best known as a member of the group D12, a group that features one of his best friends, a fellow Detroit rapper named Eminem. But Danon's real passion has always been for production. Porter got his start as a beatmaker with Eminem's hard-to-find debut album Infinite, which he produced in its entirety. But as his pal teamed up with Dre, so did Porter. Dr. Dre's mentorship led to Danon producing songs for Exhibit, 50 Cent and G-Unit, Busta Rhymes, Rakim, Pharrell Monch, and lots more. After the death of fellow D12 member and longtime Eminem hype man Deshaun Proof Holton in 2006, Porter took a break from music. But he's returned stronger than ever, releasing a brand new solo EP, Stuff in My Backpack, and taking up his late friend's hype man job on top of it. We talked to Danon via Skype from Los Angeles. If you enjoy The Cypher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you'll want to check out episode 96, where we talk to another former Dr. Dre protege, Bishop Lamont. You can also find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. And now, here's the artist, formerly known as con artist, Danon Porter. When I was reading about you, I saw that you always had, from the time you were a kid, an affinity for electronics, figuring out how they worked and stuff. That obviously helped you when you got into production. Like, where do you think that came from? Did that come from your folks?
I think it was just having a super over creative, like, my imagination is pretty in-depth. So I think it came from that. And I remember I trying to build a robot one time in my garage. It was like something crazy. I was like in there and I'm like trying to figure it out myself. And yeah, I've always had that weird just I could do anything kind of, you know. And technology is something that is always evolving. You can never really it never really gets old. There's always something new that they come up with.
Yeah. How far did you get on that robot?
Oh, not that far. It was wood. It was no steel involved.
So, you know, you got into production. Your first piece of equipment was an ASR-10. So for the folks who aren't producers in our audience, mm-hmm. What is that? And, you know, what could it do? What couldn't it do?
Well, actually, the first that was something I was able to work on at the studio was an ASR-10. My actual personal first piece of equipment was an Akai S01. And that didn't even have a sequencer. And I moved from that to an Emax, which is a EMU keyboard, and that didn't have a sequencer either. So it was a far cry from ASR-10. Mm.
So it not having a sequencer, that meant you literally had to play your beats beginning to end?
Yeah, pretty much.
After a sampler, a sequencer is the second most essential part of creating sample-based beats. While as discussed here, it is possible to create a loop without one, a sequencer allows you to program the time, speed, pitch, order, and other aspects of your samples to create an entire loop. The most commonly used type of sequencer in hip-hop is called a step sequencer. It allows you to program each individual beat or step into it so that it will play back in order. Typically, these have 16 steps, although sometimes 8, and they allow you to set which sample or samples will play for each step. They also can usually store other settings about each sample in a step, allowing you to play back a sample differently in different steps. Once all the steps where you want samples played are programmed, you can then play back your beat, adjusting the tempo of the whole loop at once to your needs, and it can replay the loop for you automatically. When you program without a sequencer, as Denon likely did here on the title track from Eminem's Infinite, it requires you to use your ear and feel the rhythm to get it right. You heard of hell when I was sent from it. I went to it serving a sentence for murdering instruments. Now I'm trying to repent from it. But when I hear the beat, I'm tempted to make another attempt at it. I'm infinite. Episode 95 guest and author of Making Beats, The Art of Sample-Based Hip-Hop, Joe Schloss points out that programming without a sequencer is inexact. It makes it messier but funkier. According to Schloss, one thing that many producers such as the RZA do is to program some of a beat with a sequencer, but then overdub some elements afterwards by hand to give it a more raw, natural feel.
Wow.
Yeah. And it, like the Kai SO1, it had 8 sample banks, and I think each sample bank, it was only like 8 seconds in a hole or maybe 12 seconds in a hole, and it was 8 banks, so I would have to put each sound on the banks. And at that time I had to use drum loops and, you know, the samples, I had to play them by finger, like perfectly, or, you know, wasn't.
Or you'd have to start all over again.
Yeah. Yeah. That was it.
Yeah. So a lot of your early beats, or, you know, what maybe not earliest stuff, but the earliest stuff that the public heard, the things on Infinite and the things on the D12, like Underground EP, mm-hmm. The drums are very, very central. There's not a ton going on besides that. Now, the dirtiest street vet from the mile. It's vexed without the Texas six-shooter. Body bullet polluter, perverted intruder. Now, who the fuck won the buck with the disease? That's this thing. I got a bitch named Trigger. My main squeeze will make your brain free. Run deep, you'll never be the MC. I stopped the alphabet at S, I got it down to a T. I'm sure you're bound to agree. A sweet MC crafts the spot. I make the roof hot like I was Rock Master Scott. Your ass forgot. Who were your kind of, where'd you learn drums from?
Obviously, I was inspired by Jay Dilla at the time, but it was Jay, his name was John Doe at the time. And when I first heard his beats, I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to do this. It was like,
well, you know, everyone still thinks that. So.
but it started with that. And then I always had a feel for just doing things by hand that way. Nothing was ever really on the one. So I was already about stepping outside of the box of the rules. So nothing ever landed on the one. It was like always off a little bit, and that created a sound for me where it was like a offbeat on beat kind of thing. It's funk in a sense,
like that like Master Ace used to do the offbeat on beat flow. So Abra, Kadabra, Presto, and Django. The offbeat on beat style is kind of strange, yo. It drops there, it's off, then it's on to the breaker, to the breaker of dawn.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, but just with drums. So that's where it really started. Like Infinite was the first. I was using those machines during Infinite, so Proof had to come in. Actually, Proof and DJ Head came in with an SB-1200 and fixed all of the drums. Like they redid some of the drums, and that's pretty much how I ended up that album actually worked. And then Just Don't Give a Fuck was the same thing. It was like the original Just Don't Give a Fuck. There was no timing. You acting in a motherfucker you bitch your style from. You ain't gonna sell 2 copies if you press a double album. Admit it, fuck it, while we're coming out in the open. I'm doing acid, crack, smack, coke, and smoking dope then. My name is Marshall Mathers, I'm an alcoholic. I'm Marshall. I have a disease and they don't know what to call it. Better hide your wallet, cause I'm coming up quick to strip your cash. Bought a ticket to your concert just to come and whip your ass. Bitch, I'm coming out. But at this point, I had developed a style, so I just kept rolling with it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, like, I guess one of the ways I might describe your early style is very sparse, a lot of the drums, and there's almost never do you resort, even in your later stuff, to, like, a more traditional boom-bap kind of style of drums.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it just doesn't, it's not a lot of resolve there. It's like if you look at a session, you know, like if you look at a Pro Tools session today, you'll see you know, where unless they like join it together and it's just one strip, you'll see where sometimes it's like they just take the first four bars and copy it. I wasn't able to do that, so I continued to play everything live all the way through.
Wow. You know, one of the things about production when you were coming up, you know, you had a mentor, you know, like Dilla, mm-hmm. Who you could learn from both from listening to and in person. Mm-hmm. Production now is very different. You know, you don't need to kind of earn your way up to being in a studio. You can just kind of get, you know, a computer and start doing stuff. So it feels like some of that mentorship, you know, has been lost a little bit. Do you have any thoughts about that?
It's a very, you know, I was having a conversation with Royce yesterday and we were talking about, I don't think that people care as much when it comes to that. Like, it's almost like they start off and it's like, okay, I'm gonna do this one thing and that's it. Then I made it, you know, there's no, ladder anymore. Mm-hmm. And today is based around a lot of, hype and, you know, appearance and all of those things. And I would imagine that, you know, we're watching, to make it simple, we're watching kids make mistakes. We watch them make the mistakes and either they get good and stick around or they disappear. You know, mm-hmm. Before it was like I made a lot of mistakes beforehand. So when people heard Infinite, it was a shitload of mistakes there that I didn't know anything about. But we did have some sort of guidance with even with the Bass Brothers at the time.
Mark and Jeff Bass, known professionally as the Bass Brothers, are a Detroit-based production team who helped shape Eminem into the star he is today. You will see them credited on albums as FBT Production. Having previously worked with acts such as George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars, Jeff produced several of Eminem's most popular tracks, including Without Me, Beautiful, and Lose Yourself, the latter of which garnered Jeff a Grammy. Jeff is also the voice of the public service announcement tracks on the Slim Shady LP and the Marshall Mathers LP.
You know, it was like they knew more than we knew. And then I was just trying to interpret what Dilla was doing. And then once I got good enough for the public to hear, I moved on to Dr. Dre as a mentor. Mm-hmm. So I was always around incredible company, and not saying that kids today couldn't do the same thing. It's just that they don't care to. Their main concern is like, I gotta place a record, and they don't care how they place it. They don't understand the business that go with it. Like they put beats on SoundCloud and then somebody puts their record out and it's like they got to chase their money down, but they don't know how much money they really should make off that record. If it weren't for producers, there wouldn't be an opportunity for a lot of people to even be stars. Like, you right. know, a person that doesn't write at all, you know, they got to find a producer, they got to find a writer, they got to find a, you know, a vocal coach, they got to find, it's a lot that comes with it. You know what I mean? That's when you need a corporate machine, but a person that just got talent, like some of these kids got a lot of talent, but they don't have no guidance. So it's a scary thing, man. But at the same time, it's like starting over. How else do you start over? They starting themselves over. The technology is there. They just don't care about the schooling.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Is that like, you know, on the rapping side too, I think you have people who saw someone like a Wayne release every thought that came out of his head, mm-hmm. but they didn't realize that he'd been rapping since he was 10 years old.
Yeah.
And so he had, you know, at that point, you know, 15, 20 years of practice so that most thoughts that came out of his head by that point were pretty good. And people catch on the like, I'm going to release everything, but not necessarily the stuff that led up to that.
Yeah. So then when they got a dose of Lil Wayne, it was like, for every time he changed, they got upset about it. it's like, no, go back to the old Wayne. It's like, wait a minute. You don't know he's learning as he's going. You know what I mean? It's a very weird thing. Like, I guess it makes my job a little harder sometimes because I don't know how to make myself not as smart. You know what I mean? I can't unlearn what I've already learned. I can forget it or I can elect to try to forget it, but habit is habit. And sonic correctness is something that I can't, you know, care about. So a lot of times when I'm listening to what's out now, it's like, why would they not mix this the right way? Or why wouldn't it be? But they don't know any better. And they probably won't even get there because there's nobody there to really, there's nothing there for them to really look up to. I mean, if they, I don't know what they look up to today. I don't know a lot of, I just know that they like the fame and the fortune behind it. And that's what the game seems like today.
Right. And so your mentors you were talking about, you know, first Dilla and then Dre, how would you learn from them? Would they sort of sit you down and teach you stuff, or would you just kind of be around while they did things and pick stuff up that way? Like, how would that work?
Well, the first person I learned from was Proof.
Proof grew up down the block from Eminem, and the two were best friends from childhood. He was Eminem's longtime hype man, and he toured with M, Dre, and Snoop in the Up in Smoke tour in 2000. He also appeared in 8 Mile, but the character based on him, Future, was portrayed by Mekhi Phifer. Proof, like Denon, was a member of D12. On April 11, 2006, Proof was shot and killed by Mario Etheridge after an altercation over a pool game led to shots being fired. Etheridge's cousin, Keith Bender, was also shot during the incident, but there are conflicting stories about how this came to pass. On April 19, 2006, Proof was buried in the Fellowship Chapel in Detroit to a full house of 2,660, including Eminem, Royce da 5'9", and thousands more mourning outside.
He was the first person that I saw be a rapper, an MC, and a producer. Like, because he could make his own beats. So he was the first person. He started off with just really tough chastising. Like, I'd play some beats, and he'd be like, man, cut that fucking snare down. A popping snare doesn't mean that it's got to be loud. It wasn't like he told me what that meant. I just had to take what that I had to take that and say, okay, a popping snare doesn't always have to be loud. Okay, turn it down. And then I had to really realize it was all about truncating and how close you cut it to the beginning and the ending and compression. And that's when I learned about those things. And then
they give you clues, but they wouldn't spell it all
out. Well, that was Proof. Proof was, it wasn't no clue. It was like, yo, this is whack. I got to redo it. It's like, and then it got to a point where it wasn't whack anymore. And it was like, he didn't say anything. And I was like, he would just be like, yo, give me this or give me this, cause it's dope. And so at that point I knew I had got to the right, you know, level. And then with Dilla, it was like, obviously I was a student and listening from afar, and Proof knew him. And I really just wanted to meet him. And I think I chopped up a sample or something, and Dilla was like, yo, you see how he chopped this up? This shit is crazy. And Proof was like, yo, I'm gonna take you over there. And I met him. And from that point, I asked a million questions when I first met him. I asked a million gazillion questions. And within like 3 hours, I'm pretty sure he was like, what the fuck? Is this an encyclopedia? Like, I didn't write anything down. I just took everything that he told me and I took it home. And I didn't leave my house for about a month after that. And but I was able to always ask him something like, you know, if I couldn't get a sample to lock up to tempos, and you know, it was just little stuff that I could learn from him. And then with Dre, I even learned from Eminem, like, because he was, you know, he started being around Dre. He came back home and was messing with beats and stuff, and so I was watching him really close. And with Dre, it was just like the sonic correctness, you know, like. I worked on the Straight Outta Compton trailer or the Grammy spot.
Right, right.
He let me mix it. I mean, I had to have a string section come in, and he let me actually produce it. And I was like, wow, this is different. It's just like,
And just to be clear, that's the spot where Dre and Cube are in the car.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize about NWA. It's nonviolent protest.
We let people know that it's okay to say what you want to say. It's crazy to see how all these different people around the world feel the same way that we feel. We kicked the door down for a lot of artists.
You know, when I was mixing it, he came in and checked it because he was still shooting. They were still shooting stuff for the movie. And so he was super busy, and I was able to come in and work on a lot of that. And he came in the studio and looked and listened to it, right? And he was like, okay, so what's wrong with this? And I knew exactly what he was trying to say. You know what I mean? But that took years of learning the fundamentals of it, you know, making a lot of mistakes and then for him to be able to sit in the back of the room and say, okay, yeah, what do you think about this? Or he would come in and touch the board and do certain stuff. And we both kind of mixed it. And it was just really an incredible, you know, opportunity. But I just learned sonic correctness from him, man.
Yeah. And kind of going back to that for a second, you know, around like 02 is when you started working with Xzibit and some other West Coast artists.
I've been this way and I can't stop. Hands on the ball and I won't drop. No. Half-ass rhyme that you can't rock to. It ain't cause I want to, it's cause I got to. Get a grip while the getting is good. Before the game is 10% skill and 90% Hollywood. I don't need that.
So I'm assuming, although you can correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, knowing Dre had something to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a huge leap forward in terms of your production from the stuff you were doing, you know, in Detroit in the mid 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that jump a little bit?
Like how it changed?
Yeah, how your style changed and expanded and how you were able to do beats that kind of read as like West Coast beats in addition to the stuff you were doing otherwise.
Oh yeah, it was just me, the influence I was around. I mean, being around Battle Cat and Dre and being on the West Coast, like I think the Xzibit thing happened because Xzibit went in the studio and Dre played him some joints, and it was like he heard Multiply, and once he heard Multiply, it was like it became his single, and that like went platinum for him. I was like, I didn't know what was going on because I was on tour. So I was what,
you weren't around for Nate Dogg laying stuff down on that tune?
No, I just I had talked to Nate a couple of times on the phone, I think, and when we were, you know, but as far as melody wise and stuff like that. But yeah, I was busy being an artist at the time. You know, we had just sold 1 million records ourselves, so it was like a very crazy time. But I think the jump came around just that being my influence, and then the one thing I ran into was I didn't want to continuously be boxed into a hole just using samples. So at that point in my career, it didn't have anything to do with the business. It was just me being my imagination telling me like, okay, I don't know how to play piano, but I'm going to teach myself. And at that point, everything that people heard, like Stunt 101, all of those things, piano, all of that stuff, that was learning how to teaching myself how to play piano. And that was the real jump, I think, for me. I was more intrigued by original music than I was taking older music and just sampling. Sampling it is still something that I love doing. But being around Dre, you know, he got all these musicians and shit. I was like, listen, I got to, you know, roll or get rolled over. And you better teach yourself. And, you know, you got to show your worth.
Yeah.
And I was a one-man band. And I think that was something that he was able to appreciate too, because I didn't play. I was like, all right, I'm not, you know what I mean, I'm not here to just be wooed and stand around and you getting tired of looking at me. Like, no, I want to contribute. So I taught myself how to play piano. He thought I played keys anyway with the way that I chopped samples. Dre thought that.
Really? When by the time he met you, he assumed just because of how you...
He just thought that I did, but it was just like I was just, like I said, I was always just, my imagination takes me further than just, you know, just sampling. I'm not going to just sample a loop. That's boring to me. So, yeah, he just thought that. I was like, nah, I don't play shit. I mean, I know what a bass is, and I know how to play a bass over a beat. But I learned that from listening to, you know, that was Detroit style. We always had this crazy bass line.
Yeah, and so... You know, at a certain point, maybe a couple of years after that,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of the stuff you did up to kind of the mid-aughts was like pretty keyboard based, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you really expanded the palette of instruments you were, you know, that are on your records.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that, about adding more and different kinds of instruments?
It became at some point in time, it became a very I started messing with scores, movie scores.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to work on Waist Deep. I was not really super interested in production at that time because this was around the time the South sound had become really, really popular. And I wasn't just like, oh, let me just let me just do what they're doing. You know what I mean? It was like, how can I make what I'm doing fit to this style or this type of a sound today? And I wasn't interested in making it. You know what I mean? I wasn't interested in doing it. So what I did was I got super into melody and music, more instruments. I was working with a lot of musicians at the time. And I didn't want them to come in and just play a piano. And I didn't want them to come in and just play strings. So I would go through and find the weirdest sounds that I could find. And just imagine a guy that plays piano, like playing a bass on a piano, but using it as a piano. You get what I'm saying? Like if it's, it's not monophonic, but polyphonic. And he's playing a bass as if it's a piano. That's an incredible sound. When you play it that way, you know, you have to EQ it a little bit and stuff like that. But that's where I just started experimenting more. That's all.
Yeah, because you had stuff like obviously the steel drum sound on the 50 Cent song.
I don't know what you heard about me, but a bitch can't get a dollar out of me. No Cadillac, no perms, you can't see. Then I'm a motherfucking B.I.M.B.
Used flutes pretty as a prominent instrument on that Outsider song on that State to State.
The way we serve crews keep birds on my testicles. I make them chew them like stir-fried vegetables. Rhyme constant while they ride Johnson. That's how my game plan stay up like John Thompson. Georgetown to San Fran, it's all one wham bam. Getting braids on the Pan Am or the Trans Am. I love them like pirates, no plans of marriage. I'm slick enough, I can sell sand to Irish. She look good
and stuff. That was like, just like I said, again, just being more, the State to State song. I'll tell you something crazy. The State to State song was one of the oldest beats that I had ever had out. That beat was already like 10 years old and it just came out later.
Wow.
And that was a sample actually. So it was like before I even knew how to play.
Man. Mm-hmm. One other thing about your production style that I wanted to talk to you about was your sense of arrangement, right? Of bringing parts in and out of songs and things like that. And I was thinking about it when I heard the song you did for Gin, that Come On tune, because it's relatively sparse and simple. Mm-hmm. But even in something like that, you have parts like moving in and out throughout the tune.
They tried to drown me, but I stayed afloat. Here's a verse for you to quote, the realest shit I ever wrote.
Come on. Now that I got your attention, I gotta say this. I know that it's been debated, I'm a gimmick they created.
Come on.
All the people that hate it because I made it to face it. When they the same ones that wish that I make it.
Come on.
All the critics that's jealous that I've created.
Who are your models for that kind of stuff? Where did you get your sense of arrangement from?
I learned a lot of that from Eminem. He taught me a lot of that. Dre, obviously. And I was listening to, you know, I'm a continuous listener of, you know, older music. 70s is my favorite time in music. Secret Life of Plants. Hear My Dear, a Marvin Gaye.
Yeah, that I was going to ask you about that record because we talked to Scarface and he's a giant fan of that album too. Mm-hmm. I think that's maybe literally the only album he has in his phone.
Everything that Marvin did up to that point was great. But when you get to that fucking Hear My Dear record that nobody probably knows about. Nobody probably know about this album.
Right, this was a album he did going through a divorce.
That shit.
Yeah.
Man, like, I don't even want to fuck around. I just want to show you, so you won't think I'm fucking with you. Okay, this is my phone, right, and this is all my shit. Look at what's on my iPad. Look at what's on here. Marvin Gaye, right? Look, there's the Hear My Dear album. The only thing that's on there is that.
That's, I can vouch for that. That was the only artist, the only album.
This is the only full album. I got a couple of songs by Marvin Gaye on here, but this is the only full album on this phone. It's phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal. You listen to what's said. You gotta listen to it though. You know, you can't just thumb through the shit. You gotta hear it. You gotta listen to the words. You gotta listen to the production. You gotta listen to the music, and then you'll understand why I feel like that's Marvin Gaye's groundbreaking project. As I feel like the Dark Side of the Moon was Pink Floyd's.
It was one of the most incredible things that I had ever heard, because it was for his ex-wife who was divorcing him, and it was like, you know what? You want some money? Here's the album. Here you go.
I guess I'll have to say this album is dedicated to you. Although perhaps I may not be happy, this is what you want, so I've conceded. I would make you happy. There's a lot of truth in it, baby. I don't think I'll have many regrets, baby. Things didn't have to be the way they was, baby.
but the songs, and you can tell the passion and the hurt in all of that album. But then the arrangements, the way it was like it wasn't even whole songs on that album. And I think around that time, I believe that may have trickled over to a lot of people that were around me at the time. J Electronica. Like, he ended up putting out, like, Spotless Mind.
X-Flex, X-Late, X2Kid. Just Blaze said, Jig is the new kid. I took Eternal Sunshine and I looped there. No drums, no hook, just new shit. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
That's the longest title song ever. But he recorded a lot of that stuff around the same time we were around each other. And, you know, I was like, man, fuck the rules. Like, you don't got to do a whole verse. You know what I'm saying? Like, apparently later people got mad about it. Because it's like, you know, if you think about it, if you put a whole project together like that, if you listen to Dre's new album, it's not a formal album. It's not formatted the regular way. You know, it's arranged differently.
Yeah. And you could, for example, do something like a 9-minute epic about murder and betrayal like you did with Pharoah Monch.
Cops coming.
God, why is my wife bleeding? She covers her face, paramedics are leaving. Her eyes are closed, it's apparent she's not breathing. I'm a little confused about what it is I'm seeing. Plus there's a naked man on my lawn. Police in the living room with all of their guns drawn. Out, and the last thing I remember is I received.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
What on earth was that like, talking about the song Trilogy?
Yeah, Trilogy. I wasn't, again, at that time, Pharoah was the only person I worked with at the time, because it was right after Proof. And that was the only music that I made that came out, that I released, that I was okay with releasing. And I was like, you know what? That's when I felt like a lot of producers were, it was just about the check. You know what I mean? No slight to anybody, and I understand everybody has their own, you know, positions and situations and trials and tribulations, but at one point in time, I felt like it was just about the check. It wasn't about the creativity, and I was listening to music, and I was like, man, I wasn't impressed by anything. And not saying that I'm the greatest whatever or this and this and that, it's just my opinion. At that time, I wasn't impressed by anything. I wasn't motivated by anything, and so the Trilogy song was basically like, I had those songs, I made those songs for Pharoah, and they were each individual songs, right? And I was like, you know what? Here, you can have all of them. Because I didn't give a shit about music at the time. I was like, I don't care. I don't care. You know what? You want these? Here, you can put them out. So what? Here, you can have them. I was trying to do movie. I was working on that movie score and working on that world, and I basically just took the songs and pieced them together. We had the idea to make it one story. And that's how that came about. But the arrangement on it was like, I wanted to make sure that it was arranged perfectly. And each song goes into the next, each song, and then you start hearing it later. It's like, it's funny because I'm, when I hear the way the albums are today and the things that I was thinking about before, like around that time, like 5-10 years prior, you know, before that, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, it's just, it's good to hear. You know what I mean? So that means I'm a little ahead of my time in a sense when it comes to some stuff. So, you know.
Yeah. So you mentioned movies. I wanted to just ask a few things about movies, movie soundtracks, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You have a pretty long history with movie soundtracks yourself, with D12, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you talked about doing the music for the trailer. What was it like to see that spot? This was the first taste a lot of people are getting of this NWA movie. Maybe even in some cases, the first they were aware was happening at all.
Mm-hmm. I flew home to watch it with my dad. He had had a stroke like, maybe 2-3 weeks before that. And that song that we used was a song that when he first heard it, he told me that I should give it to Dre. He's like, yo, you should play this for Dre. It sounded like he made, you know, and the message, there's an actual whole song and that song was going on the soundtrack, but when Dre started making some changes, I think in the last 3 months, it didn't really fit the speed of the album. So it was a moment for me because I was sharing that moment with my dad, and that was like one of the most important parts of it. Along with every time, I swear, that day he told me, if I look back in time for everything that I did as Denon, as Mr. Porter, as a producer, I've been a part of huge parts in history, in hip hop history. And this was another accomplishment because obviously NWA was a lot of the world's favorite group at a time. You know what I mean? Like, it's like to be a part of that and to kick off that campaign, I was like, hey, you know what? Being a part of history all the time, that's a beautiful thing for me. That's a beautiful thing. It may not matter right now, but, you know, when I leave here, I definitely left a mark on this earth. And that's what I always wanted to do. And I have to, you know, I have to be more thankful about it, you know, sometimes because I wake up every day and I feel like I haven't done anything. And that just was a real great moment for me to see that. I watched the Grammy. I don't never watch the Grammys. Like, even when we perform on the Grammys, I'm like, shit, I don't want to watch it either. I don't want to watch it. Like, the Grammys aren't, you know, I haven't watched the Grammys in a long time. And that was the first Grammys I watched in forever just to catch that spot. And then after the spot, I was like, all right, I'm done watching this. I'm going upstairs.
So movie soundtrack wise, you know, mm-hmm. D12 has been on a bunch of stuff. You know, you guys did The mm-hmm. Longest Yard, Barbershop 2, Furious 5, even Shark Tales, which I definitely want to ask you about in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get a song on a movie soundtrack? Is it usually a pre-existing song? Is it something you write for the film? Like, how does that work?
I personally have always wrote for the film. I've never done anything that I just gave them. And that was me building a resume in a sense. Because I think that's where, when I'm done, if I'm ever done with music this way, that's a great resume because I can write to it. It's like, I think if you have a song, it's great to do that. You know what I mean? But I think it's even better when you can understand what the premise of the movie is and then give something to it. You know what I mean? Like, make something for it. So I always enjoy doing that.
And how does that work? Like, you get approached by the people in the film, or you hear that a movie is happening and you pitch stuff? Like, how does that work?
Let's say the Southpaw soundtrack, like, they, you know, Paul sent me an email and it was like, yo, we want you to do a song. I had just put out a solo record. It was just like an EP. A solo EP. And I think I was doing a lot of moving around and I was just in a really good zone. And like, he was like, hey, you know, if you got a song or something, like, let me hear it. And M had this beat and he had an idea. We talked on the phone and M sent me the beat. And I was like, I was like, okay, let me do a song to this. So M produced me in a sense. And it was fun. It was like a really fun thing.
I came upon the wrong side of the fence. I gave my family pain and strife, and that's the mob. out for strength. But hell in my defense, and I got too much way too fast. Mama told me it won't last. Now I'm back down on the bottom, wishing that I took another path. I should've listened.
Me and M saw the movie maybe, I don't know, 6 to 7 months previously. So sometimes people call you. Sometimes for me, like Furious Five, like Slaughterhouse was new. They was just signing, I think. And I thought it would be a good idea for Luda and Slaughterhouse to do some shit. Because Luda was trying to get back into this, just a real, just going back at it with the lyrics. You know what I mean? And so I was like, hey, you know what? It'd be a dope song if you did a song with them, because these dudes are the guys right now. Like, you know, lyrically, I feel like the best group.
Tell these other boys double love, cause I got some work all on my waist, but I call it a tummy tuck. My every record's jumping or playing double dutch. I shit on rappers, every verse just got the bubble guts.
Let me tell this to the people not understanding my moxie. Animal watch me, if you think it's tender, will stop me. But then I hit them with a flow that they can't even copy. See, we don't play that way, I'm from us like fantasy hockey. Sup with a dog.
And that's how that happened. And it's just different ways, man. I never did a meeting. I never met with anybody to like sit down to do it. I usually get called, or it's an opportunity that comes my way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I have to ask about Lies and Rumors, which is a song that D12 did for the movie Shark Tale.
Now this thing here ain't cause concern, but it's another story about a shark eating worms. It's not a riddle, but subliminally catches on. I want a little lock to turn into a bigger one. When I was a young guppy in the sea, you could see all the bigger fish picking on me, because they knew it didn't really have a guard or bullet. Any other sharks that have teeth sharper than me, I'm a never.
What was it like doing a song for a kid's movie?
Oh, so much fun, man. Like, I'm already a cartoon, comic book kind of guy. It was perfect because D12 could actually do that. And now, mind you, as raunchy as the group is, I was already had the idea. And the funny part about it is, was me and Proof were already, we already knew we had to do it, right? And sometimes when you're in a group, it's like, you know, the guys might be scattered doing other things. You know what I mean? And I remember us being on tour, and I was like, Proof, look, if they don't come to the studio today, I'm doing this shit myself. I'm like, because I already got this idea in my head. I just want to get it out of my head. So I started the beat, and I already had, that's why I ended up with the first verse, because I was just going to do the whole song. I already had a whole song wrote. So that's how that happened. It was like a management told us that they were doing it, and it was like, hey, you know, you should submit a song. And I was like, oh, well, we don't have no song that's going to fit a kid's movie.
Like, right. You can't do Shit Can Happen.
Yeah. Hell no. So, yeah, we just, I made the beat, and I had the hook, and the studio loved the song. I think I have a good connection with film and making music for it. And that's what that's like I said, that's the direction I'm going into.
Yeah, you see yourself doing full on film scoring and stuff in the future?
More so like music supervising and actually helping them get the right songs for the right scenes and things like that. Because I do find a disconnect with that. You know, I've noticed that a lot of people do great jobs, and then sometimes they don't.
They'll kind of shoehorn the hit single the moment into a scene, even if it doesn't fit.
Yeah, it's like, I don't, you know, they worry about sample clearances. They worry about a lot of things. And I understand that, but I think that's where I can, you know, be a difference. I, no slight against anybody that's doing it, but I think that's what the difference is that I can bring is like, look, I can play it. I can sing it. I can write it. if it's a sample, I know how to make something sound exactly like it, so you don't lose the feel of a song. Like, I've been doing it my whole life.
Right. And, you know, Dre has done that once or twice in his career.
Yeah,
also.
Exactly. So, you know, it's like, you know how to do that where it's not,
yeah.
You know, you don't lose anything. So I think it's just, it's a fun, man, that's a very fun experience for me.
Yeah. And, you know, as far as D12 goes,
mm-hmm.
One of the things, especially I think on the first record that jumped out at me, I remember at the time, was it felt like it wasn't like a group of six people. It was almost like three duos in a sense,
mm-hmm.
You know, that it split up to be kind of like you and Conniver especially kind of mm-hmm. tag teamed off each other a lot.
Yeah, I took them all gone with some Parmesan, and I think my arm is gone.
Y'all's probably numb, young, dumb, and full of cum. And I think he about to swallow his tongue.
Scary ass, it was a false alarm. You think about to die when I
die. Yo, the line, you seem shook.
I really am, dog. Look, this fat bitch keep chasing me, trying to give me the nut.
Aw, man, you probably let her wrong.
I just bought her a beer.
I saw her rubbing on your head while she was wiping your tears.
I admit, I was high, but you ain't see me crying.
Nigga, you lying,
ain't mm-hmm.
you?
Can you talk about kind of your relationship with him and his style and how you two kind of played off each other?
Well, we were a group before that. We were a group before that. So for us, it was more natural. And I think it was like, I guess just because that was the dynamic that we had brought to the table automatically, you know, because when we first started the group, I was like, well, look, if we're going to do this, I want to bring Conniver in, you know what I mean? Like, because I thought he was dope and it was a compliment to my style anyway, you know what I mean? So, like you had Ray and Ghost, they weren't necessarily a group, but people always put them together when you looked at Wu-Tang, you know what I mean? And I felt like that's what we were. We were always like, we wanted to be EPMD.
Yo, I'm the hip hopper, Buster Show Shocker. Down with MD, yes, the microphone doctor. One Rex, the other the swears. And if you think you're ready to mess, kill the noise. We don't play when it's time to slay.
You know what I'm saying? Like all of the great duos, we wanted to do that. And that's why it was easy to do for me and Conniver. Like that it's just, it was a natural dynamic already.
Yeah, that definitely came through.
Mm-hmm.
So with Devil's Night, with the first D12 album,
mm-hmm.
what was that like, the process of making it? Because you know, just because of, you know, Eminem's status at that point, you know automatically, sight unseen, that you're going to have a giant audience right off the bat. So how do you make a record with that in mind?
I didn't know if we would have a giant audience. I can honestly say I didn't have any expectation. Because I didn't want to get let down. So if they were like, you know, you didn't know if it was if it would work or not, because even Interscope had their doubts about it. We had to prove to them that it was worth doing too. That's why we did Shit On You first, as a single.
I shit on you. I spit on you. Start pissing and do the opposite on you. You want to listen? Set up cop a squad on you. Start spilling my guts like chicken corn on blue. And straight shit like Notorious Big did to that bitch on that skit on his last album. Pull my pants down.
I shit on you. Shit on you. I don't care who you are. I shit on you.
Oh, interesting. That's why that was out first.
Yeah, because we had to win them over too. And that deal wasn't a big deal. It's 5-6 people in a group. That wasn't a big deal. You know what I mean? It was like a very small deal. But doing the album, recording that album, I can honestly say that it was, for me, look, it was a humbling experience, number one, because I'm like, okay. Normally I'm making the beats and I'm coming in and that's my part and I'll rap and I'll do whatever, right? But then it was like M was doing production at the time, you know? And so I was like, I was learning and I was also trying to make sure I had my ego in check too, you know what I mean? Like, cause I was like, yo, let me do what I usually do. And I didn't know how to, as far as that, I was like, I was going through, I had a lot to learn. It was a lot of, for me personally, a lot of shit to digest. And then the song structure. We made the mistake of everybody having to be on every song. That was when you had like American Psycho and it was me, Bizarre, and M, and then you had Instigator. Like we should have did that a lot more, and it would have helped establish each person individually. And I think that's where we made the mistake with that blueprint, but it worked out, you know?
Yeah.
But I can look back at it and say like, oh, I would have did this differently. I would have did this. But it was a learning experience, man. It was going from nothing to that and recording in this big studio and not worrying about the time. That was different. Me and Em would, we were the studio rats. I can say that.
Mm-hmm.
I would stay until the mix was done. You know what I mean? Like I was learning. I was trying to learn the whole process.
Interesting. And it seemed like that record, you know, you learned a lot. I know, you know, Shit Can Happen, for example, you know, I mentioned that song earlier, but you, you know, experimented a lot on that beat. Mm-hmm. You grew a lot on that beat. And Blow My Buzz was the first time you sang on a record, right?
Yeah. M tricked me into that one because I was always messing around, you know, when we would go out and I'm screaming at the top of my lungs. And but I mean, I could sing. I just didn't. It was like, okay, that shit don't fit in hip hop. Like, I didn't know, you know what I mean? I wasn't embracing it. So we did that song and he's like, yo, Nani, just try it. Just do it. And, you know, that's one thing that he does. Like, he'll tell me, like, yo, just try it. If you like it, cool. If not, whatever. At least you tried it. And that I've been that way ever since.
Yeah.
Especially if he's like, yo, just try it. I mean, recently, like, I've learned what I'm comfortable with and what I'm not comfortable with. And I think we just now, after all of these years, got to a dynamic where it's like, I don't know about that one. I don't know if I'll be able to do that. Like, but most of the time, if you know, I'll try anything, you know, just to see if it works.
Yeah. You know, as far as singing goes, obviously you have quite a family history with singing. Mm-hmm. Your grandfather is a gospel singer. Your father was a gospel singer. Mm-hmm. Was there any pressure on you to sing, or did you sing gospel growing up at all?
No, I couldn't even repeat a gospel song, man. I really couldn't. As much as I was around, I don't remember the songs, but I was timid. So I wasn't able to get up there, and my dad would have us sing like at home, but I wasn't getting up in no choir.
there was never any pressure to try to do that professionally?
No, at the time I wasn't trying to do that. I was trying to play ball. I was trying to play football.
Okay.
Yeah. I wasn't really into that. I was like, that's my dad. That's what he does. He's like a superhero at it. I can never do that. I'm all right. I'm straight.
But then you start singing and, you know, you're working with some of the best singers mm-hmm. out there.
Yeah.
You know, you start writing hooks for other singers, you know, people like Jamie Foxx.
Mm-hmm.
People like Bilal.
They say don't give second chances, but ain't nobody gonna make me feel like you do.
What's it like writing hooks for someone else's voice as opposed to your own?
I only do it if I feel like they would even like it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to get something back and it turns into a whole different thing that I don't like. But Jamie has a similar. I'm a fan of him. Period. Like however he sings. I think he got a dope voice. Bilal obviously is an incredible singer, and a lot of that comes from a lot of Bilal sounds like what I grew up around, which was the old quartet, gospel quartet kind of groups. So the people that end up writing hooks for, or they just end up singing them, I kind of have them in mind, I guess, when I do it. And if I don't, you know, and they pull it off, it's like I'm super happy about it. It's a weird thing, man, because sometimes I get it, and you know, I've got a couple back. I won't make any, you know, say any names, but I got a couple back where I was like, what the hell is this? You know what I mean? Where it was like, it was just totally not what I was trying to interpret, mm-hmm. and it didn't work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that was just because it's different singing styles, and some people hear differently.
Yeah.
They hear differently. Some people are by the book. Once you play by the book, there's no creativity besides what the book says. You know, and that's with singing, that's with rapping, that's with battling, that's with production, that's with anything. Once you play by a book, you already set up a whole bunch of walls around you to tell you how you have to be creative.
What are some of the things you've learned about singing from being around people like Bilal or J. Jamie Foxx or even, you know, Mary J. Blige or John Legend, like singers you've, I don't actually know if you were in the studio when when they did that song with Buster.
I got a clearer view, and being that you're always there for me, I'm here for you.
I made a decision.
There, one thing that I learned was you're always going to hit a wrong note. But if sometimes hitting a wrong note will help you come up with the next note. So that was like one of the best things that I've, like working with Bilal was like super fun because with him, he'll go through a million different notes to get to one. You know what I mean? And that's a very hard thing to do. But somebody like Shakira, she's different. And you know, she'll know exactly how she wants to say it, or if you kind of sing that note, she'll try it. You get what I mean? And it might sound better when she does it than when you do it. Or let's say somebody like Sting, he's just a master at him. He knows how he's going to sing. You can give him something and he'll sing it totally different. Like however Sting is going to sing it. He know exactly his range. He know where he's good at. He know where he not good at. You know what I mean? So like, you just learn how to not be afraid to hit the wrong note.
Yeah. Jumping back to D12 for 1 second, you know, I was reading an interview with you about sort of the early years with the group, you know, right after, you know, you guys were blowing up. And you said, I can't remember shit about those years.
Yeah.
Why is that? And like, if you had to do it again, like, would you do anything differently?
I can't remember a lot of it because of there's some things that went on when I got shot when I was 15. And as life progressed for me, when I went through that, I was, you know, it was pretty bad. Like I flatlined like 3 times in the surgery. For some reason, I don't have a good recollection of the past at all. Not even being a kid. Some stories I tell repetitively so I'm able to remember them, but I'm only good for like 10 stories. and if somebody tells me something, I can just kind of remember it. But you know, those years, they went by real fast, man. I imagine that somebody like Chris Brown or somebody like that, right? He may not remember, every day may feel like Friday to him. You know, I had a job before. Like, I worked a job as a kid, and had a couple jobs. So did M. So did Proof. Like, we all had jobs. It was so. I think regular life just there was no regular. You know, it was regular to be standing in front of 80,000 people, and you kind of forget. One day just intertwines into the next, and unfortunately, it's a very hard thing to keep up with, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't Instagram, and it wasn't no Instagram or Twitter then, like, you know, when I first started. So you can't go back and look at that shit.
Yeah. You ever, you know, pull up old video clips or something and just be like, wow, that.
You know what, man? So I had a whole bunch of videotapes. I don't know what happened. Somebody stole all that shit. I don't know where that shit is. It was like, it'll pop up one day. Somebody, whoever stole it, it'll
pop up on YouTube or something. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I just remember a whole bunch of my stuff getting stole. I was the one that was moving around a lot because I was being a producer. I was being a artist at the time. And I mean, I dabbled in a lot of things, you know what I mean? So I was never stationary. I've been like that since I was 20 years old. So this is the most stationary I've been. Like I'm spending a lot of time in California right now, and this is the most stationary I've been in, I don't know, 17 years.
It's interesting how you phrase that too. You said I'm spending a lot of time in California, not I live in California.
Yeah. No, I'm always living in Michigan, but I'm right now spending most of my time here. I'm thinking I'm going to be in Atlanta for like 2 months and I might end up being there longer. Who knows, you know?
Yeah. And one more thing about the past and how it plays out. What is it like for you to watch 8 Mile? I've heard you talk about it and you said that it's like, it's your past, but it's like pieces are jumbled. You know, there are composites and, you know, stuff happens, but in different orders or happens to different people, or, you know, one person is sort of, you know, two people are made into one person, something like that. What is it like for you to watch that movie?
If anything, I was watching it a lot because I was learning the acting part of it by watching M act. How different was he in that movie from who he is originally? You get what I'm saying? Because the characters, obviously the characters are mixed up. I don't know if that's I don't know how movies work. I don't know if that was like, hey, well, we don't want to have to pay every fucking body that we like, you know what I mean? It might've been that thing or something, but you know, it was just like the guy's name was David Porter. You got dreads like Proof, and you know, me and Proof, I think we're the closest to him. You know what I mean? And the big guy, Bizarre, that obviously was like resembled Bizarre more so. But me and M worked at the plant together. I mean, we worked at the cooking at Gilbert's together, and Canava actually worked there too. So, and then it was you know, watching it is just like, I don't know if it brings back some memories. You know what I mean? It brings back some memories, and but I would say it's like it's just great to watch because I'm watching my friend excel into a different, you know, realm. So even as old as the movie is, it's like I still watch it, and it's fun to watch.
And you know, your most recent release obviously is the Stuff in My Backpack EP. Mm-hmm. So you've been pretty open about that, kind of hearkening back to a vibe of like Tribe Called Quest and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you remember when you first heard Tribe?
Yeah, it was Benita Applebaum. Well, actually it was Push It Along. Push It Along was the first song I heard. And then I heard their first album, and I was interested, but then when I heard Benita Applebaum, I was like, oh man, this is the most beautiful thing I ever heard in my life.
Benita Applebaum, you gotta put me on.
Benita Applebaum, you gotta put me on. Benita Applebaum, I said you gotta put me on. Benita Applebaum, you gotta put me on. Benita Applebaum, I said you gotta put me on. Benita Applebaum.
I was interested then, but then when Low End Theory came out, that was it for me. I was like, oh, this is who I want to be completely. I want to be whatever this is what I want to be about. This is what I want to represent. This is what, you know, at the time, it was like, they called them backpack rappers, and that's why I called it Stuff in My Backpack.
You know, on the song Told Y'all, mm-hmm. on that, you say, you know, my career is not a post on IG.
My career is not a post on IG. So they ain't ever seen the likes of me. Likes of me. Likes of me. Fuck what you believe. I agree. I played the game long enough to appreciate the little iron wheat. I am heat.
And that just got me thinking about social media and someone like you who started their career before that was really a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having to adjust to that. And I noticed you're very, very open on Twitter, you know, talking to fans a ton.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like for you to get adjusted to social media, and kind of what role does it play now for you?
Well, that line, my career is not a post on IG, so they ain't never seen the likes of me, was like me saying, you know what? Most people believe that shit, you know, like they believe what they see. It's like if I post a picture of a Ferrari, it's like, oh, my God, he's rich. I might just be posting a picture of a Ferrari that I see walking by. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, you didn't say it was your Ferrari.
Yeah, I didn't say it was mine. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not even in the cars. Like, I expect too much. There is no adjusting to it. Like, it's not like I'm so old that I couldn't. I just can't. I'm afraid to believe that people are that stupid. I literally fight and argue with people on Twitter. I don't have a problem with it. You know, you get friends or whatever. Like, there's friends that talk to me and be like, yo, you don't think that maybe you should just not answer them? It's like, why? I don't want this person to think that it's okay to call me a fat fuck or you know what I'm saying? And and I'm not supposed to say anything. Like, listen, you fans have to remember something. You're fans of a person for a reason. That doesn't mean that you're supposed to dictate everything that they do. You can't bully me and scare me and say, well, I'm not buying your record. You know what? Half of the fans on Twitter are fans of Eminem, and I'm Eminem's friend. So I don't even know who's my fans anyway. Like, I'm not even there to, I like talking to people anyway. So I might talk about something that don't have anything to do with that, you know, and they miss out on great people. Like, you wouldn't know what kind of sense of humor I have, or you wouldn't know anything about my life. I'm not going to plaster that on Twitter and all those things. So it's hard to, I'm still in disbelief and denial that people are dumb enough to believe like half the shit that they see. That, you know, it's like I get to show Eminem this picture. Okay, yeah, well.
Right, I'll get right on
yeah,
that.
I'll yeah, I'll get right on it. I'm so sorry. It's almost like, and not to mean, I'm not a, it is very sad. It's almost like I'm not your servant. I'm not your slave. I'm here to share my thoughts. If you listen a little bit, there's more to me than just the fact that I grew up with, me and my best friend just happen to be these people. You get what I'm saying? Like, it's a very hard position to be in, and but I enjoy actually going off on people, so I don't know if I'm like sick for liking it or not. Like, I kind of like, I don't care. I'm like, I cuss at people, I block them, I don't care.
Yeah,
it's like I'll let them talk for a minute, and then it's like, all right, I'm done with you. I gotta click. I gotta get out of here. But the adjusting part is, it's not hard to adjust. It's just, you know, you catch up and you keep up. You know, it's a lot of funny shit that happened. Like, I do love talking to people and finding out like about their lives too. You know what I mean? Like, oh, it's my birthday today. Like, really? How old are you? You know what I mean? Like, or what are you doing for your birthday? Like, you know, it's conversation, but at the same time, it's a lot of crazy people out there, man.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine you see more than your share of it.
Yeah. More than I want to. Sure.
Yeah. So we're talking, you know, right after the year anniversary of Ferguson, of the events in Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring that up because, hey, the opening song on Stuff in My Backpack, it sounds on the surface like a very upbeat tune.
Oh, me? What's up? Oh, well, hey, my name's Denon. What's up with that head, girl? You change your mind?
Yeah.
Well, ain't that fine? Because that was like a broken hourglass, girl, a waste of time. I'm back. I really like to thank my spine for holding a nigga up so I can't recline. I got so much credit that I can't decline, and I flip your dad's wife like she ain't your mom.
What's your name, man?
Denon.
That it was actually inspired by the Michael Brown verdict, right?
Yeah.
When I read that, it kind of didn't make sense.
Yeah, it was, we were at home, I was actually in LA, and I was at Woodland Hills at the time, and it's a house full of people, and we like, me and my homies, and we sitting there, and I'm like, yo, this is a very sad thing. You know what I mean? Because you watching, they just murdered this guy. They murdered him. There's no, I saw a lady grab a cop's gun and they didn't murder her. This guy was walking with his hands up, right? And you murdered him. They murdered him. There was no way to look at it. And the cops weren't, and what was the verdict? The cops got off, right? If I'm recalling the right case.
Yeah. Yep.
So
yep.
They got off. So I just got to a point, man, I was in tears. I went upstairs. I mean, for a second, I laid down and I was like, you know what? This is the worst feeling in the world. It's like, I can do, it doesn't matter what I do. It doesn't matter who I stand in front of. It doesn't matter what my job is. It doesn't matter, if I make people smile with a song or if I make them cry or if I make them think. If a person feels like, and I'm not just making it, because obviously Eminem is white and that is my best friend. I don't look at that dude like my friend, that's my brother. I was laying there thinking to myself, if a cop feels like pulling me over and killing me today, all I'm gonna be is just another nigga. Excuse my French. And I didn't wanna, my day just started getting dark, man. And I was like, went downstairs and my friend, this guy Jake that shot the video, he was from Minnesota. And he was out in L.A. and he was at my house. And I was like, yo, man, let's shoot something right now. He's like, well, what? I was like, I got this song. Let's just shoot this song. It's fun. Fuck it. Let's go have fun. We went to rent bikes. And my man, if you saw the video, my man Marv One is the big guy on the bike. And I thought that was hilarious. And he was on like a tricycle and shit. And I just needed some fun, man. It was like, it was too fucking, it's too dark, man. I don't, just to know that you still not want it. Like, let me ask you this. And I hope that we can get to this point in this interview. What really is the problem? Like, what did we do? I understand that some of my people do ignorant, very ignorant and scary shit, but it just is, it's the same thing on the other side of that fence. There's a lot of people that do ignorant and scary shit, right? But technically, this, we not even, if we want to go back in history, black people ain't from here. We not even from here. We got took, we were taken from a place and we have nowhere to go. So if every black person disappeared tomorrow, not just for every, you know, like every, like saying every white person hate black people. I'm saying for the people that are really, really racist and they like, I hate niggas and I hate this. And the same thing for everybody else, right? Where can we go? Nowhere. So I decided to go to the beach and shoot a video. I said, fuck it. It had me in tears. They killed the guy. And it's 2014. And you still killing black people like that. You still killing people, period. Get rid of everybody's guns. I wish that they would just get rid of everybody's guns. And then you really see who's weak and who's strong. You know? I think it's a sad thing. We just live in a crazy country.
Yeah. And, you know, that video really does capture a sense of joy. And it makes all the more sense now that you told kind of the story behind it and that it started at such a dark place and kind of needing to counter that, you know, any way you could.
You can make a song that's like, that was downbeat. You know what I mean? Like, even if I did God Laughs, it wouldn't have made any sense to do it at that time. Because I don't want to tell another story. Like, I don't need to tell a story of how sad I am all the time because people making me sad. You know what? You're not going to break me. I'm going to laugh at you because I think that people are stupid. I think the people that do that, I think the cops that did that, they will be brought to justice. We just won't see it. They got to answer to God like I do. You know what I mean? We just won't see it. That's the only thing. I think a lot of people are upset about that, too. Like, man, I want to see them. I want to get my revenge by watching them get their heads chopped off. Like, yeah, well, die with them if you can. That's the only way you're going to be able to see it, because the justice system ain't for us. It's not here to help us. We're here to apparently be target practice sometimes.
You know, in the God Laughs tune that you talked about there for a second, it struck me because you have this moment in it where you're wondering if people are laughing at you or laughing with you.
This fan that I met said I was funny. I asked him if he was laughing at me or laughing with me. Life is what it is and ain't always the fairest. I try to be Christ-like, but they'll never compare us. 9/11 when the towers fell.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious about what was behind that. Was there a particular incident or series of incidents or feelings that kind of inspired you to write that?
It felt like when somebody tells you that you're a funny person, right? It's like, yeah, I know I have a super weird sense of humor. And sometimes it's just like, that's all I'm about. You know, you wonder sometimes, like, are people laughing at the fact that this is happening? How many people are sitting in their house and they're looking at us, all of this happening, you know what I mean, on the news? And how many of them are laughing? Because they're not crying with us. You know, there are some people that stand with you. There are some people, look, I've never seen, if we want to do anything, we can give ourselves a pat on the back, because I do see a lot of, I see white people doing the same thing. They upset too. You know what I mean? And it made me feel like it doesn't, like I'm taking myself back to whether you're a fan or a friend. You might not be laughing with me. You might be laughing at me. I may be talking about this serious issue and they can be like, ha ha, he think that he's going to make a difference. You know what I mean? It's a question that I ask myself a lot.
Yeah. And you actually had another release after that. You had the Great Depression AP, a limited edition, you know, vinyl thing that isn't new material. It's unreleased material from kind of the mid-aughts, right? It's sort of post Proof's passing. That time you were talking about earlier when you were talking about Trilogy, when you felt like you were kind of done with music.
That is a instrumental album that is, like I said, the only person that I was working with was Pharoah Munch at the time. But I was creating beats, but I didn't really listen to them. And I had put them all together in this compilation of a beat CD, we call it, obviously. It was at first called The Anchor Man, because I felt like I wasn't concerned with making singles at the time. I had just came off a run of making singles for people. You know what I mean? And I was more concerned with making songs that actually fit the artist. Not, let me make some money off pop culture. And I wanted to feel like I was contributing. Cause I like the artists that I work with. I was fans of them, you know? So I was creating a lot of beats at the time, but I wasn't listening to them. And so from 2006, to 2010, a lot of those beats, no, 2009 actually, I hadn't listened to none of them, and that's what this, and the Great Depression is just a compilation of all of those beats. You can hear how confused I was. You can hear about the things I was talking about. It's not songs. It's just instrumentals. It's beats that the only people that heard them was Marv One, and the only people that used any of them was Marv One and Royce the 5'9". And that's what that the Great Depression is. And with the Great Depression, there was two songs that I created. One was called Where Will I Go, and that was the song for Proof. And another is called, it's an unreleased D12 song with Proof. Well, it's not a D12 song, it's just me, Proof, and Kanava, right? And I only have two copies, one copy of each one of those songs. So one person that buys, I guess, the special edition album, they get the one copy of that song, and it's only on vinyl.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and that's not an enticement.
Yeah. It's like I feel like we share so much shit today. You know what I mean? Like, nothing is sacred. You share everything. And I wrote a letter with each one of them, and it's like, hey, you know, today I feel like we live in a world where everything is digitized. Here's a song from me to you. You'll be the only person with it. I don't even have a copy of it at that point. So it's just those, and it's not each person gets a copy of both songs. They both get one or the other. They either get the unreleased D12 song, or they get the one song called Where Will I Go? And I'm singing that whole song. It's not a rap song. It's like a John Mayer-ish kind of record.
Wow. And what is your status with D12 right now? I know one of our listeners actually went to see them in Europe not long ago and noticed that you weren't performing with them.
Mm-hmm. I haven't performed with them in a long time. And like, obviously I love those guys. Like, I'm just focusing on trying to find out who I am and who I want to speak to. And, you know, I felt like they all had an opportunity to really do the solo thing. I was the one person that never did it, you know, and I'm just taking this time right now to do that. Like, we did the Bane song, the Bane song for the Shady 15.
Devil out to get me, moving pretty fast. Head on collision, I'm trying to avoid the crash. Bang, I'm running from my past. Bang, that's why I wear the mask. These blood-sucking leeches.
And that was fun. And so, I mean, right now, I'm just really focusing on myself, and I have a project that I'm working on and I'm holding super close to my heart right now is Tierra. It's called Queen of the Damned. And she's my daughter. So I'm working on that. And that's the closest thing to me right now. Like, I don't have any plans for anything with D12, you know, right now.
Mm-hmm. You have a solo album you've talked about over the years, alternately calling it Nine or I think Memo.
Yeah.
What's the story with that?
Well, with Dre's album in the Compton album, like, and all of that. Like, I took a little time to like contribute as much as I can to different things. Then the Southpaw thing came up. So after, I'm not going back in to finish that until October. I wanted to put it out this year, but I think the single will be out by the end of the year. But maybe somewhere around my birthday, that's like December. So I'm not recording anything else for it until October. And I'm literally like 60% done with it. So it's done. It's just I have to add, you know, a couple things here and there to really finish it. And it's only 9 songs. It's nothing more than that.
And what involvement did you have with the new Dr. Dre album, with the Compton album?
A lot. We actually did a lot of songs, like a lot of stuff that I contributed was more so early on, and it didn't make the album. You know what I mean? Because what a lot of people don't get is when you're making a record, after you listen to it for a certain amount of time, you start making changes. You know what I mean? Like right at the end, when he finished, I was working on the Southpaw song. So, and it literally happened like within three weeks to a month. So I was around a lot.
I was going to ask about that. Like when did you first become aware that there was going to be an album that wasn't going to be called Detox, that was going to be, you know, a different thing?
Oh shit. He was working on it for when they started the movie, maybe halfway through the movie, I think.
And it was just starting from scratch, all new material, nothing that was kind of in the can.
Well, he did have a couple of records that I heard. He used one of the records from a batch that was from Detox, I think, around Detox time, which was Talking to My Diary.
Now I remember when we used to do all-nighters. You in the booth and Cube in the corner writing. Where Ren at? Shout out to my nigga Yella. Damn, I missed that. Shit, a nigga having flashbacks. When I open up my book, I think about the world later. No ink in the pen, no lines on the paper. I'm just talking to my diary. I'm just talking to my diary. Sometimes when I gotta...
He had that song, but I think he just had to wait until it was the right place for it. You know what I mean? Like, that's a touchy issue for him. Like, I know that Dre is not super keen on just talking about a lot of that time in his life, I think. And this movie inspired him. And one day he just ended up getting super duper inspired and was like, all right, I'm doing the album. And I didn't, you know, because we had been through a couple versions of this, I was like, okay, whatever you say, Dre, let's do it. You know what I mean? I'm like, I didn't know if it was going to happen or not. But then I noticed halfway through, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, if he's doing vocals 4 and 5 times, like, yeah, this is really happening. So I knew for a minute, I'm just one of those people where if he's like, I don't want him to feel that fucking pressure of what people was going to say. You know what I mean? Like, as soon as he said Detox, it was like everybody was talking about Detox. And they put the pressure on him. It wasn't like he was telling them every week. That's what fans did. And so if he would have put Detox out and when it was out and called it Detox, they would have been like, oh, well, this ain't what I expected. Because, you know, that's what kind of fans we got today. We don't have the fans anymore that's like, yo, we're fans because we're really fans. We have fans / critics. And so I knew that he was recording it, and obviously I was around a lot. And I just wasn't going to be the guy that helps put that kind of pressure on him, because I want my brother to put the album out. I wanted him to put the album out. There's nothing more than I want. You know what I mean? I want to see him happy. I know that's gonna make him happy to get it out. And so he was working on it for what I knew of, maybe 7 months.
Wow, which in the grand scheme of things is not a long amount of time at all.
Hell no.
Beginning to end.
Nah, nope. And he can pull it off. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of the new material, like a lot of the songs that I heard, it was some songs that I didn't hear that was new that he had just did. So I had heard a couple of new things, like, so I was like surprised too, you know.
Wow, so there was stuff that ended up on the album that you didn't even hear till the very end of the process.
Exactly, because I mean, my song was it was a song called Sob Story that we had, which was actually the music that was in the trailer with him and Cube, and that was on the album. It was, so at first that was on the album, and then what happened was, He got another burst of energy and did some new shit. He was an animal in there, man. He was an animal in there. He was really working his butt off to like to get it up, to get it done. And I think that's what's dope about it is like that movie probably inspired Dre in a way that nobody and nothing else could in a long time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And finally, I did want to ask, you know, we've got one more question about D12, which is sort of the obvious one, like, and it's one you joked about on my band.
Look at him, little punk ass, thinking he the shit.
Yeah, I know, man, by himself taking all the flicks.
Hey, I thought we had an interview with DJ Clue.
No, I had an interview, not you two.
You gonna be late for sound check.
I ain't going to sound check.
My mics are screwed
and
up.
His always sound best. You know what, man? I'm gonna say something.
Hey, yo,
you got something to say?
Man, nothing.
I thought you was about to tell him off, man.
What's which is this idea that you have a group, you're all friends, in a sense, you're all peers, but by the time you're actually making records, you know, you have that set up, but then one of you is a superstar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was that like?
The group was a lot easier for me. It was easy for me to hide behind them because, again, I probably should have been the person that was putting out a solo record because I have an uber amount of talents. And I could put a record out without anybody's help. I could produce it. I could write. I could do this. I could do all of the things at once, right? So I was hiding behind that. The hard part was with the Eminem dynamic, obviously, it's like with anybody, it's going to be like, you got to still be able to show that you're talented. You know what I mean? Because the focus is going to be on that. And then when you have so many people in the group, a lot of times it was a lot of clashing with ideas and creative, you know, things. So that part was a lot more easy for me because it was my group and it was my friends, right? Just imagine now, add the dynamic of not just being a part of that. Okay, you got Eminem on one side and you're in a group with him. But then you're a producer and you're sort of a protege of Dr. Dre. But then the other person that you learned from was Dilla. And the first person you had to impress was Proof, who was like the Detroit king. You get what I'm saying? So for me, the group was that part. Hey, let me just hide behind these guys, play my part, play my position, right, and shut the hell up.
That sounds like a lot lower pressure situation than you were used to.
A lot lower pressure situation, man. A lot lower. And then, you know, I didn't expect all of those fucking, I just wanted to make beats for people. I didn't go in thinking like, yeah, I'm going to be this big producer. And the first record I do was a platinum hit for Exhibit. And then it goes to PIMP. Then it goes to Stunt 101.
I shoot out of stunt, my wrist stay rocked till my TVs pop up in the Maybach Benz. I shoot out of stunt, nigga, you can't see me, my Bentley GT got smoke gray tint. I shoot out of stunt.
Look at me now, and then you know.
Stunt 101 was this weird thing where, like, you know, 50 was, you know, literally at the height of his
mm-hmm.
sort of commercial powers. Mm-hmm. He's releasing this album, and they used your thing as the lead off single.
Mm-hmm. I didn't expect all that. So that's a lot of pressure to even have for the, you know, to have, now you got to come up with this, come up with that. And then you go in the studio with all of these different kind of people. I wasn't, obviously that, like I said, the group part, that part was easy. It was way bigger fish to fry outside of that for me.
Sure. And real quick, over the past few years, you know, you've been Eminem's other half on stage.
And Dr. Dre said,
Slim Shady, you were basing. Watch your face red, man, you wasted.
Well, to say 12, I'm melting. I'm so.
Which is another.
Oh. Right. Which is a whole other thing. So, you know, kind of the main thing I was curious about that, what surprised you about it when you started doing it? Because, you know, you can envision, I think, oh, I'm going to stand next to him and I know the songs, I know which lines I have to finish, you know, I know he, you know, what his tour route is or whatever. What was the most surprising thing once you actually got in the role?
Well, first, I don't know what lines I have to finish because you never know. Yeah, you never know. And that was a surprise because it's scripted. You know, your stamina ain't going to be the same every day. I think the biggest one was probably the fact that I was able to do it. I spent most of that time trying to figure out how I was going to, I wasn't going to be able to replace you can't feel proof shoes. That wasn't an option. It was like either bring your own shit to the table or you can't do this, you know? And I was able to develop my own sort of style of doing it. And that was something I had to work at. But it was also like, I think the other surprise was that they were happy with my work. Cause I didn't know what to expect. You know what I mean? I really didn't know.
Why isn't Infinite available commercially? And do you think it'll ever be, or is that not on the table?
I don't know. I think because the people who we did it with, that might have a lot to do with the Bass Brothers. And if they were to release that right now, like, they would have to pay me a grip. They had to pay me a grip because, like, I got screwed around way early, you know, messing around with them dudes. Like, I thought they was, you know, they I don't know what they doing right now, but it seemed like it's something that should happen, you know. And if they did it, like I said, I would have to on my end, I wouldn't be the same stupid kid I was then. You know what I'm saying? Like, cause
yeah,
think about it. We went to Africa and it was kids holding up a fucking sign that said Infinite. You get what I'm saying? Like, we didn't know at the time what we were doing. It was like, it's not something that I think M would just drop and put out. You get what I mean? But if those guys that we did it with, the Bass Brothers, I mean, if they would have to, I don't know how they would do that. I'm pretty sure they got all of that shit, you know?
Yeah. But, well, Mark and Jeff, if you're listening,
yeah,
doors open.
Yeah, doors open. call me with a number. I'm out. I'm cool right. with it, but I don't think that my issue is that. I think that's more so, it's a lot of red tape. Like, you know, they would have to talk. I would only do some shit like that with Paul, because Paul is more creative when it comes to how to do that shit. All I know how to do is, like, let me create some shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, Paul is a genius of, yo, we should do it this way or that way. And I don't know if they could, because if they did it themselves, they would have to do it in a special way. That was a special project. And we keep, for whatever reason, a lot of these younger kids, like, I think they gravitate towards that retro sound. So it was a dope album.
And it's kind of like, and it's a hidden thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you have to sort of, or at least you did at one point, mm-hmm. have to work to find it.
Oh yeah. Like it's definitely one of those things that I go on YouTube every once in a while and check it out, and then I start listening to our voices and I'm like, oh fuck this shit. I'm like, listen to this shit. It's like, but it's dope to see, like, cause we didn't know that it was gonna do anything, man. Like, I'm happy that people can even make the correlation then to now. And if they did do it, you know, I'm down for it. But shit, that's, you know, Paul is great at that shit, man. Like, he just, that's some shit he would do. Like, he's great at, like, finding a way to make some shit work for a certain reason. Eminem's manager.
Yeah. And so finally, like, what's going on with you? What's, you know, immediately you have the song on the Southpaw soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Like, what else is going on?
I don't know if what there's something else I think that may be happening with that, with the Southpaw thing, but I'm working on Tierra right now. That's the most important. Is Tierra like the you know, the princess, mm-hmm. The thing that they were, and it's called Queen of the Damned, and I'm just working on that right now, and she's a monster. Like, I feel like that there's a void with female MCs. Like, it's like, we can't just keep accepting one person or two people and be like, okay, that's it. Like, cause there's a lot of dope female MCs out there. You know what I mean? Like, you got Rhapsody, who's incredible. You got Nikki, who's dope. You got, Jean Grey. You got, like, obviously Iggy Azalea and Azalea Banks, people like that. You know what I mean? But I have something that is, I think Tierra is going to be, it's a spot. Like, you got Missy Elliott. We missing a certain element. There should be more than just what we have. And I mean in a major way, not in a situation like, cause I know 3D I think her name is 3D Natty. I think there's a void missing, and I'm hoping to fill that with Tierra.
Cool. And any more kind of offbeat instrumental projects for you? You've done, you know, Porter Chops Glasper. You have the Great Depression. Anything more like that on the horizon?
Yeah, I'm definitely working on. I have another two different Porter Chops that I'm working on right now.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's like one is already done. I'm just vocally is getting done, which is with Guilty Simpson, and he's working on it. So he's doing vocals, and the sad part is he was in the middle of the Random Acts album, and then Sean Price died.
Oh my God! Yeah, I mean that's yeah.
So it's a tough, you know, really, really crazy. Him and shout out to him and Black Milk, man. You know, my heart goes out to Sean Price family. And but I'm working on that one with him. And then I'm doing a Stevie Wonder one with it's called Marvin Wonder. And it's all Stevie Wonder's chops, and it's Marv One. So these two that I'm doing have vocals on them. It's not just instrumentals, but then I'm going to put an instrumental out of them. And they're not, you know, it's not something that we sell and we just stuff that we working on and I'm putting out. I always like to, that's the weird thing. I'm going to go from major label kind of shit to underground shit. There's anybody that's listening to this. Don't let the world tell you who you got to be. You don't have to dress to part. Like, you don't got to come to the party with all the gold chains on. You ain't got to do drugs. You ain't got to be, you know, a man whore. You can be, it's fine, but you don't have to be, you know, to fit in. Don't worry about fitting in. Do what you do. The time is changing. Like, the hype is dying. A lot of people are in it because of the hype. A lot of people are in it because of they're not going to last. Remember the 80s was a time of music where you didn't even know who the hell these people were when they had singles out. It was just like somebody singing and it was a big record, right?
Yeah,
that it's the '80s right now. You know, a lot of people probably are discouraged behind the fact that they got all of this talent and they can't get a shot. And that time is coming to an end. No offense to the people that's doing it. Hey, great, had your shot, but you got to be able to stand up to people that actually have talent. There's people that know how to do everything, and I mean that in the most respectful way.
Excellent. Well. Thanks so much, man. I really, really appreciate this.
No, man, thank you. And I appreciate your time and I appreciate you listening.
His time as a part of D12 aside, Danon has built a significant legacy as a producer and now as an artist. I'm glad we were able to dig into it in this episode. He's produced some of my favorite songs from the shady Aftermath G-Unit camp, including ones we didn't even find time to talk about. And his songs with three-time Cypher guest Pharoah Monch are among the best in Pharoah's catalog. You can find Danon's solo work, including that Porter Chops Glasper record that we talk about towards the end, on his Bandcamp page at danonporter.bandcamp.com. Join us next week for a conversation with the great Master Ace. From his early days with the Juice Crew to his recent slew of imaginative concept albums, Ace has always had a unique vision and the rhymes to back it up. Those rhymes have been recognized by some of the top artists in the game, some of whom even asked him maybe to write some stuff for them. As I mentioned, make sure you subscribe to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
I'm afraid to believe that people are that stupid.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
It was a shitload of mistakes there that I didn't know anything about.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Their main concern is like, I gotta place a record. And they don't care how they place it.
Special thanks to this month's top Patreon supporter, Vikram.
I just learned sonic correctness from him, man.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher. Yeah. And like I said, I will, as soon as we hang up, I'll text you